This is Link to the Cast, your weekly dose of video games and nerd culture ephemera, available everywhere good podcasts are sold. I am this week's party host. I am the platforming prodigy. I am Mark Robinson. And with me, as always, he is the Hertfordshire heartthrob. He is Jack Lazell. Jack, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks, mate. And yeah, that absolutely would have been a fantastic indie wrestling gimmick at some point in the in the past. I feel like maybe it's too late to start training at 33, but you know what?
Ah, look, Diamond Dallas Page started in his mid-30s.
Yeah, he was also a fitness manager at a gym or something, wasn't he, at some point?
Something like that.
I definitely could put worms in my mouth and smash like a clock over my head, but I don't really want to do that because both of those things suck.
Well, I remember your, so we, you know, back in secondary school, like 15 odd years ago or so now, I never came up with like a wrestling moniker, but I know that you went under the name of Food Love, which...
Yes.
Which, I'm sorry, but there's money in that.
I mean, you know what? It's another indie wrestling gimmick that is untapped potential. You know, instead of like just a tie-dye t-shirt with like a chicken wing in the middle of it, just walking out there.
I never went to one of those types of shows, but I remember around like our area where we lived, I remember once I saw a poster and it didn't have like the name of a company. It just had the American Wrestling and it had a bunch of people that were doing, you know, Z-rated copycat gimmicks of like the likes of The Undertaker and The Rock. And I never went to one of those, but I have to imagine that was like the most carny fucking low rent wrestling experience one could possibly have.
Yeah, genuinely. I guess it takes the sort of lookalike thing to another level though, because at least you've got people trying to emulate. You know how like you get like, you can hire lookalikes for parties and stuff. Like, oh, if I want to hire a lookalike David Beckham for a party or a lookalike Brad Pitt or like something, I can go hire them to just literally stand around at my party and look like a famous person.
I was thinking more like those tribute bands like Noasis or something.
Yeah, exactly. High on Maiden.
But in fairness, I saw a covers AC/DC band at our local venue in Hartford. I can't remember what their name was, but they were an AC/DC tribute band.
Livewire, TNT.
Name any fucking AC/DC album from the last 40 years.
Yeah.
But they were really good, but it kind of freaked me out because the guy who was doing... he wasn't doing Bon Scott, he was doing... Brian Johnson. I can't remember. He was doing a Brian Johnson tribute and he was like fully in the character. So he was doing this high screeching, like between songs, doing some sort of Geordie accent. And
was he actually a Geordie though? Or was he?
I don't know.
So meta that he had learned how to do a Geordie accent from watching his Ant and Dec tapes to go on stage and talk to the audience in a Geordie accent.
Yeah, I don't know if he was, but if he wasn't, then, you know, he's fully in the character. And I was thinking is like, fair play. And they're actually pretty good. Like, they're the closest I'll get to seeing AC/DC. And I'm not fine with it. Probably would like to see the real thing, even in 2021. But they were still pretty good. What's the best tribute band you've ever seen?
See, I don't know. This is where I might come out as a heel. I'm not a massive fan of tribute bands. Really, I like a band like slipping a cover every now and then of a song by a band that they like or that influenced them, or like, you know, if someone dies or something, people play their music to kind of, you know, sort of elevate or like awareness of it or and stuff like that. I quite like that. Or like an album of like, you know, say like on the front of Kerrang or whatever, it's like somebody's recorded Metallica's Black Album.
Yeah. Do you remember when they did the Metallica, I can't remember what it was in celebration of, and fucking there was Sum 41 doing Master of Puppets.
Yes. That was just Metallica Icon on MTV.
That was the one. Yeah. I couldn't remember what the name of it was. Like there was that, there was Limp Bizkit, they had fucking Sanctuary. Oh God, what else was on there?
I wasn't Snoop Dogg on it. I swear Snoop Dogg was involved in it somehow.
Sounds like something that would have happened in the early 2000s.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, a whole thing of somebody just doing one band songs, I'm like, I kind of don't like it.
Okay, all right. I'll rephrase the question then. What's the best cover of a song you've seen done live?
Jesus.
Because I already know the answer to this question. And it's We Are Scientists coming out to End of the Road.
Yeah, I mean, they did do End of the Road very
And
well.
like, did they end with End of the Road, or did they end with Against All Odds? Because I know they back ended with that.
Yeah, they Against All Odds, I think, is what they closed with. But yeah, three like nerdy, pale white guys walking out on stage in suits to a headline gig at Brixton Academy, daring to sing End of the Road, is just hilarious to me in every possible way. But that is a really difficult question. I think Weezer covering Wheatus's Teenage Dirtbag, just because they said everybody thinks that we recorded this song anyway, so here's the song, at Reading that year, was very funny. But yeah, like there are serious answers that I just, you know, that I'd have to really sit and think about this question, I reckon, if I was going to come up with a proper answer. But yeah. Beats me, my friend. I've seen a lot of music, a lot of bands do a lot of songs over the years. So yeah, I'm not 100% sure what the answer to that is.
Well, speaking of wrestling, as we were there a second ago.
I just thought of one that I liked.
Oh, okay.
My Vitriol, but with Paul Draper doing Wide Open Space by Manson, was pretty cool, which is a very niche one.
That is incredibly niche that about three people listen to this will probably get. And I think that's more just, it was cool to see Paul Draper, because obviously we got into Manson way after they ended. So
True.
Yeah, but a good shout. And that was the last night at the Astoria, if I remember.
It was. The Astoria was like a historically great venue in London, for anyone that didn't know. Just literally every possible amazing band that you can think of that ever came out of the UK played there on their way up. It was that sort of like just a venue above a club, but not quite like a Brixton or like a arena type show where you could go. And, you know, there always felt like a buzz when a band was playing the Astoria.
Now it's a train station.
Now it's still incomplete train station,
which is fucking unbelievable considering how long it's been since they knocked that building down.
Hey, Mark, the last time I was on this show, me and you spoke about how they'd spent, like, what was it, a few million quid on a stupid hill. So are you surprised that we can't get the whole Crossrail Central London rail project thing, like, finished in time? Because I certainly am not. Anyway, this is enough train talk on this show.
we've really reached the bottom of the barrel, haven't we? I wasn't planning to stay up all of last night. We're recording this on Saturday morning.
Oh, did something happen last night?
Well, yeah, I watched the series 3 of Parks and Rec. It got to about 2:50. And I'm like, I didn't even think I was going to still be awake, because I had no intentions to stay up, because I'm 33 now and staying up till 4 a.m. is not a time that I enjoy. But it got to 2:50. So I was like, well, I guess I'm fucking watching Rampage then. We had the suspected but never officially confirmed return, or I guess debut in AEW, of one Mr. Phil Brooks, one Cookie Monster, Chick Magnet, CM Punk. Now, of the two of us, I'm the one that is still slightly more invested in the world of professional wrestling. I know you've had a kind of malaise with the product in the past.
Should we go with extended hiatus?
Yeah, all right, we'll go with that as well.
Yep.
But from what I'm understanding, you either did you stay up or did you watch it this morning?
No, so what I did I had a really bad headache last night anyway, so I kind of like just went straight to sleep as soon as I could. And then this morning what I did was open up my laptop, didn't click on any social media, didn't click on anything, just clicked on there. Completely legal way to watch Rampage from last night. Opened it, like, just sat with my room in complete darkness kind of thing, and just
by the way, Fight TV, if you want to sponsor the podcast, we're listening.
Yep. And then put it on the TV and just drunk the whole thing in, the noise, the sound. It was just exciting, Mark, you know, to see. Do you know the thing that I the thing that I always love in wrestling is when you have a completely genuine moment. Okay, so they spend so much time trying to manufacture things. And look, some manufactured moments in wrestling are better than others. Some are very, very good. Okay, but nothing, and I mean nothing, will ever be a genuine moment. This person who, you know, anyone that watched that documentary that Punk released with WWE could tell how much all of this meant to him, like the sport of professional wrestling. And he gave it up because he was so beat down and so sick and so tired of everything that happened to him in what really was at that point the only platform really big enough to kind of project him to a worldwide audience. And he probably thought, I'm never coming back, because he knew he was never going back to WWE, because, you know, a bunch of stuff that happened, like most notably them serving his termination notice on his wedding day, which is still one of the least classy things I think that's ever happened in the history of professional wrestling. And that is a pretty big history. And then here he is. There's finally a platform, like a legitimate platform that could actually do everything that he kind of wants. They could be the size, they have national TV, they have a bit more creative control. There's a genuine care and love about the way that this thing was set up in AEW. And the show opens, you hear some static, you hear the opening riff of Cult Personality, and literally, I haven't heard like a reaction like that from a wrestling audience probably since like the last time you got like a sort of Rock Austin kind of return.
Well, I was going to say, since the last time that Punk was in Chicago for a big monumental event.
Yeah, it was insane.
Yeah,
and the guy came out, and to be honest, like, again, the genuine thing, like he got down on his knees like he always does to do his clobbering time thing, but he stayed down there for like a minute because you could see from his eyes he was like welling up with tears. He looked so overwhelmed. He went, like, he started walking down the ramp. He's just kind of dumbstruck, and he lost himself for a second and just jumped into the audience. And it was just such a, the whole thing is just completely free of any cynicism or like shittiness or anything artificial, anything constructed. Like, everything about it was a pure moment. It was everybody in that building and him just connecting on a level that it felt special. And you know what? Even if he goes on and nothing else happens from here that's of any, you know, consequence, which I'm sure it definitely will for him because, you know, he loves what he does. And I think that he'll find his feet there very quickly because, as he proved with his promo last night, there's like a genuine, just natural aptitude and talent for connecting with audiences that he has. But that moment is literally the best thing I've seen in wrestling for I can't even remember how long. It was awesome. Sorry, I want to get your opinion and takes on everything, but as a person that hasn't been involved in it for so long, it just really touched me. It I wouldn't say I was on the verge of welling up, but I was marking the hell out by myself in my bedroom at like 8:30 in the morning while I had it on the TV, and I just had to turn it up as loud as possible. And I've rewatched that pop 2 or 3 times since, and I'm not ashamed to admit it.
No, I mean, it's curious to hear because, like, I've seen a couple of people that I follow on Twitter that were also either awake or have been talking about it since, that don't watch wrestling or haven't watched for a long time, like friend of the show, Chaz Ali. He was like, look, I have no emotional investment to this, but even I think this is pretty fucking cool. So that is, this has always been this talk in the past 20 years post Attitude Era about the casual fan and how to get them back, which I think is just, it's not really a thing. Either you like wrestling or you don't. And it's dependent on the product and how much they want to push you away, which WWE have been doing a very good job of in the past 10 to 15 years or so. And it was just, it goes without saying that just watching it was just, it was a kind of a surreal experience because there was the 10, 15 seconds between when the show started and you had that kind of few seconds of silence before the opening riff of Cult of Personality started. And it was just, there was just a palpable buzz that you don't get. And I wasn't watching wrestling through like the bulk of the Attitude Era. Like I started watching wrestling the beginning of 2000. So I missed, you know, kind of, I don't want to say peak Austin because he was still massive when he came back, but that 98, 99 run, I missed that. So I can't compare it in terms of that buzz. But the comparison I just made there about, you know, Punk 2011 Money in the Bank, you know, that was there's such a feeling in the air that we've not really had since. And I mean, like, for me as someone who's been watching wrestling still in that time, most of the New Japan stuff in the past 10 years has been incredible. There's been so many brilliant matches, but there's still only a niche audience that can cater to. And even with the stuff that New Japan have done with, you know, having American commentary and making the show more easily accessible and all this kind of stuff, which they should be commended for, it's still... there's still going to be a barrier that some people are just not going to be able to cross over to, no matter what you do. So it's always been like, okay, when is that competition in North America going to show itself up? And I think AEW has been tremendous over the last 2 years or so. I think they did a really good job in handling everything through the pandemic, handling everything around like the stuff with Brody Lee. And Punk actually said, like, in the kind of media scrum after the show last night, that one of the things that helped to make this decision was seeing how much they protected, like, the secrecy around what was happening with Brody Lee at his request. And that kind of put a lot of trust in the company for him. So it's just, you've clearly got a company that cares about what it's doing, cares about what it's doing, cares about its wrestlers. And obviously just... it's not going to, you know, I saw a tweet about how if this is WWE and Punk was returning, he would have had like Miz and Morrison interrupt after 3 minutes, and then he'd face Miz like for the next 10 weeks, and then just all the buzz would be gone. And it's sad, but it's true. And you just, you know, that's not going to happen with AEW. So yeah, I was curious to see if they would set up any angles or anything. And I mean, I guess they did set up the match with Darby at All Out, which is awesome. I think that's a really cool opponent to start with. But they didn't need to
them in the rafters, by the way. Yeah. Sting and Darby are like, it just felt, and they didn't overdo it. Like, they didn't, you know, have a face, anything like that. They just had Darby, like, this is what he'd wanted. Like, he'd set it up in the media beforehand. Like, I want to face the best in the world. And yeah, it was just great that just seeing Sting in the rafters, by the way. I don't know, like, it's again, it's because I'm in my head, it just takes me back to just being a kid, like,
yeah,
crazy crowd reaction for a guy that you really love, Sting in the rafters. It's all the things that made you connect with wrestling when you were a child.
The best thing I did see was on the Voices of Wrestling account, and Rich, who was there live, tweeted that his wife, they call the nurse, I was like, huh, I've just seen 15,000 men come all at the same time.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, she's probably not far off, in fairness.
The guy, like, he was just openly weeping. Yes. And I've seen a lot of people mocking that. And I hate that because, look, I guess some people think wrestling is silly or something.
I mean, it is. It is silly, yeah, and it is ridiculous.
But some staunch WWE fans as well think AEW silly or whatever, because they, for some reason, some people have to ultimately defend a brand rather than just, like, you can enjoy everything, right? You know, I could watch Premier League, La Liga, Bundesliga. I love football. That's fine. I listen to lots of different kinds of music. I watch lots of films. I don't just play Nintendo. I play PlayStation. I play Xbox if I need to, right? Just enjoy pure moments. And that guy, obviously, wrestling, and then probably then in turn, CM Punk, means so much to him, so much that he became so overwhelmed that he started crying. And in my head, like, you know, there might be the cynical part of me that's like, wow, he's gone a bit far then. But that's ridiculous, because when you really think about it, if you connect with something to the point that it can move you to tears,
it doesn't matter what it is, as long as you're connected to it and emotionally, exactly, invested. Yeah.
It was a pure moment for that guy. Whoever it was doing the editing and the cameras and stuff found the guy in the audience, smashed it, cut to him at the right time. And, you know, maybe in like a few days' time, when he's received his 50th text message from his mates taking the piss out of him, he might regret it. But in the moment, that was how he felt, and he let it out. And for me, there's something, again, it's not manufactured. It's not something that's been created. And I'm not saying it's bad to manufacture or create things, because sometimes they do it well. But when it's pure, when it's honest, and when it means something, it's just so... it just elevates it a level above. And yeah, that's just perfect. The whole thing was so spot on. They nailed it.
Are you going to like continue watching on a weekly basis now? Are you going to jump in, jump out when you hear of anything? Like, what's your kind of forward projection with AEW?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely more interested in watching now. I kind of had seen a few. I'd kind of checked in and stuff for the pay-per-views and bits and pieces, like with Dave and a few others that would watch. But
and no, this is all completely forgetting that we've probably got Bryan Danielson showing up in a couple of weeks as well.
Yep, exactly. So yeah, I think I definitely will have more of a view of it than maybe I would have done before. But yeah, this is the sort of thing that can bring people back in, having this guy show up, because, you know, for that generation of people, you know, who were sort of late teens, early 20s, from like his run in ROH all the way through to him being the best in the world in WWE, the guy means a lot to people. And yeah, he continues to, even now, 7 years later, people don't forget. Some people go away and they lose the buzz, but him going away sort of almost like retained it and almost become sort of like this legendary, mythical, will he ever return type person. And now that he has, I mean, it couldn't have been any bigger of a feeling for people. And I'd never, even Twitter and stuff, obviously I follow a lot of people that are into the sort of nerdier culture pastimes, but the buzz from it, like, and this morning, like, I woke up and Cult of Personality was 9th trend in the UK. For God's sake, just a song was trending 9th in the UK. It's just mad. Like, the attention that it's brought is just crazy. I love it.
And I had to feel that this comparison has been made before, but he is looking more and more like John Hamm every day.
He looks like a mixture between John Hamm and obviously Mike Patton from Faith No More at this point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, he looks good. Like someone put that comparison picture of him up, of like when he was in WWE the last time.
I was watching, I've been going through some like SummerSlam matches here and there, and I was watching the build up and the match with him and Brock. And Punk in 2013 is the most tired looking man I think I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
He just looks like the hell has been beaten out of him consistently for a year.
Yeah, exactly. It's the eyes, like the big rings around the eyes, like the body language, like his hair was all of a state. He wasn't even wearing like, you know, like hoodies that kind of looked clean or new. He just had some gray, misshapen shitbag hoodie on. And he just generally looked like a man who was at the end of his tether. And he even said that in his promo. He was like, I needed to get well, spiritually, mentally, blah, blah, blah. And that was never going to happen for him. And I like the fact that he didn't actually call WWE out by name in his promo. He heavily hinted at the fact that it wasn't pro wrestling, it was sports entertainment, but he didn't say sports entertainment. He didn't say any of that by name. There was just enough hints in there to see exactly what he meant. And the fact that he said he didn't even know what he was going to say when he went out there, and everything he said had such weight and such meaning, and he managed to cut through everything. It's not like he was standing out there for like 15, 20 minutes saying catchphrases like The Rock does. And now, don't get me wrong, I love it when The Rock does that, because I am still a 10-year-old kid in my head and I absolutely love that guy. He's fantastic. But he doesn't connect with an audience in the way that Punk connects with an audience. He may connect with an audience in a way that is worth a lot more money, but the people that really care about CM Punk care about him in the way that they don't really care about The Rock. People really think The Rock is great and funny, but they just love, like, there's something in the pit of the stomach for the way that people seem to care about CM Punk. So yeah, it's not as money, but it's definitely more intense for the people that care, I would say.
So let's move on to what we've been watching. And I'm going to start with you, Jack, because one of these things myself and Dave spoke about last week or the week before. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Time is a blur. So it's a flat circle. I guess I'll start with your thoughts on Suicide Squad so we can wrap a nice little bow around this.
Yeah.
And push it off the side of a cliff.
Look, I'll keep it brief because you guys covered it. I listen to the shows. I hear you. Don't worry about that. I was actually listening to this bit I was on the Bakerloo line when you guys were talking about Suicide Squad. So when I picture that conversation, and I'll just picture the Bakerloo line bumping and humping its way through. But I really liked the Suicide Squad, you know. It kind of just felt like just a bit of a sort of a sideshow, fun thing. It doesn't necessarily feel like a movie that's going to develop. into anything else, even if they kind of try, because it's a one-time deal. It's a one-shot for James Gunn before he goes back under the Marvel Cinematic umbrella. And it just felt like, creatively, a bunch of people having a bit of fun, making a silly movie, not really giving a shit about the consequences of any of the things that were happening in the movie. And yeah, just everybody involved in the project seemed like they were just enjoying themselves on screen. I thought John Cena was fucking hilarious in his role. Like, they managed to get the best out of him because he's not the best actor. But what he does do is that sort of over-the-top, earnest, nonsense delivery thing very, very well. And he nailed it in that movie in a comedy way. And yeah, I just generally really had a good time with the Suicide Squad. It was silly. It made me laugh out loud quite a lot. The fucking fact that the final boss of the movie, spoilers, was a giant fucking starfish is hilarious to me. And it looked as ridiculous as a giant starfish with a big blinky eye in the middle of it should look. Yeah, and just fun, man. It was just fun. Idris Elba was brilliant in the movie too. Margot Robbie, I've never seen, like, every minute she's on screen as Harley Quinn, you can tell she's having a blast, even in the movies that kind of sucked.
She is unequivocally the best thing about this whole DC universe.
Oh, like, she's brilliant.
Bar none.
It's like someone's given her this character and she's like, you know what? Like, she's, you know, she's done serious acting roles. She's done comedy. She can kind of do anything. But this one, it kind of feels like, you know what? This is just for me. I'm doing this character to just enjoy myself in the sort of way that, you know, I don't want to give him a mention by name because of, you know, kind of more recent events, but the guy that played Jack Sparrow, he always looked like he was having a real good time doing that as well. And I feel like Margot Robbie is the equivalent of that, where it's like, you know, she would probably do this for less money because she just enjoys getting into that character and just connecting with it in a way. And yeah, there's a fantastic sequence of her just absolutely cleaning out an entire building. And yet her sort of relationship with the javelin guy, one of the bits that I laughed at the most in the movie was where she just shot that sort of dictatorial guy who she just kind of like pledged her undying love to, and then changed her mind the second she realized he was a tyrant. How often do you see that in movies? Like, normally you see somebody, like, you know, fall in love with someone, realize they're a tyrant and not know what to do, whereas Harley Quinn just got a massive gun and just shot him and he died seconds later, and you were like, yeah, that's pretty much what should happen every time someone realizes that the other person that they've just hooked up with is an arsehole. So yeah, to me it was, look, was it a good movie, like in the sense of, like, is it the sort of thing that, you know, you're going to go back to and watch time and time again? No. But was it amazing schlock? Yes, it was amazing schlock. It is a sort of film that if I watch it once every couple of years, I don't think it will change the way I feel about it. I'll just enjoy the silliness of everything that's happening in it. So it's a sort of 7/8 out of 10 kind of movie for me. And yeah, well, James Gunn, what a guy. That guy knows his way around putting a smile on the face of nerds, because he put a big smile on my face when I watched Suicide Squad. And I'm sorry that you didn't like it, Mark, because yeah.
That's not a thing you need to apologize for.
Yeah, I just thought, like, you might enjoy the silliness of it. It kind of felt like one of those
elements.
Sort of...
Elements of it, I did. Elements, yeah, of it, I did. But I just, I think if that film was about half an hour shorter, I'd have had a better time with it. Because it does not need to be as long as it is. It does not deserve or warrant the amount of the length of the film.
Yeah, there's bits that you could cut out. Or personally, I feel like I could have had maybe 10 minutes more of the weasel.
I could have had 10 minutes more of basically Malcolm Tucker being on the screen.
Yeah, that was the weakest part of the movie for me, is that they had absolutely no fucking clue what to do with Malcolm Tucker.
Which is just like, you got Peter Capaldi, like, just fucking let him scream and rant. Because the few moments where he does that, I'm like, yeah, I'm on board with this. Maybe it's, yeah, just because I'm missing the thick of it. I don't know. But
what was his connection to this big starfish monster? And then the second the starfish got loose, it just immediately ripped his body apart. And I was like, oh, okay, fair enough. I thought maybe, like, we would see him, like, riding it like some sort of giant horse across and wrecking the streets of the weird, like, sort of strange South American nation that they created, but no, it just ripped him to pieces immediately. So yeah, some of the story beats or whatever, you're not looking for anything serious. But yeah, I love the start of the movie. It's like, oh, here's a Suicide Squad, and they're actually the squad that were just immediately taken out, and then they cut to the other beach, and then the real Suicide Squad that we're following for the rest of the movie, and the fake out of them actually using like known people, like say like Pete Davidson or whatever. I was like, Pete Davidson's in the movie for like 5 minutes to be just immediately destroyed. I quite enjoy that. Give me more Weasel.
The other thing that you got on the list, which sounds like an NWA pay-per-view from the Cow Palace in the 80s, called Malice at the Palace. I have no idea what this is.
Yeah, so Malice at the Palace is like, it's maybe hour 5, hour 10 documentary. It's very much in the mold of ESPN 30 for 30, in that it picks out like a moment in sports history and kind of explores into it. But basically, what happened was there was a game in Detroit, a basketball game, and at some point in the game, like right near the end, one team was beating the other team convincingly, but there was like a flagrant foul and there was like a little bit of a brawl between the two teams, and then it kind of stopped, but the fans in the venue were not particularly, you know, happy with the fact that this is their, you know, this is their home kind of town team, and they're getting beaten, and now like they're getting the team, you know, the other team are like hammering into them or whatever. And then one fan decided to throw something at a guy called Ron Artest, who was like one of the instigators of the sort of like brawl initially, who was just happened to be like lying down, you know, while the ref calmed everything down, and hit, something was thrown at him, and he responded by immediately running up into the crowd and then trying to get the person that threw something at him, which, you know, probably not the smartest thing, but you can understand what happened. And then all hell broke loose in the building. There was a massive brawl, all of the fans and the players and people on the court, and like police coming out to try and keep the players safe on the court, and everyone throwing stuff at all of the players. And yeah, it was crazy. And the Malice at the Palace documentary just kind of tells the inside story of all of these players, how they ended up on the teams that they ended up on, and how they ended up in this moment, and kind of what led to it. And then just sort of covered the really horrific thing in the media afterwards of, so this was like 2004. So, of course, the media were like, because, you know, these are sort of young, rich, black guys. So they're immediately like, these guys are thugs. You know, these guys are, you know, this thug hip hop culture and basketball. This is awful. You know, won't somebody think of the children, was kind of the way the media reacted in 2004. And yeah, it just kind of tells the story from top to bottom of that. And it's just over an hour long. It's just a really interesting kind of snippet and insight into how something which, yeah, you know, they kind of went over the line, and it was kind of a bad move from the basketball players kind of involved in the brawl at the time, but then it being blown up and just horribly like ground out in the media as some sort of racist witch hunt. And yeah, it's a really interesting documentary. It's not very long, but it is good. And yeah, if you're into sort of 30 for 30 and stuff like that, I think you'd really enjoy it. Or, you know, everyone watched The Last Dance. By the way, forgot to mention the CM Punk Michael Jordan note with the just, you know, I'm back, announcing the future career plans class. But yeah, if you're into 30 for 30, you like The Last Dance and stuff, I'd go watch Malice at the Palace, because I didn't know too much about it. I'd heard Malice at the Palace before, and like you, Mark, I thought it sounded like the name of a wrestling pay-per-view. But yeah, it was good. It was a good head-to-toe story to cover what happened at this event.
All right, so I got one thing this week, and I've only actually watched one episode of it. There's only one season, but what this show is, it's kind of hard to watch more than one episode at a time. It's a show called The Midnight Gospel. So first of all, Jack, I want to ask, have you ever heard of this?
The Midnight Gospel. I've seen the name, but I have literally not a single clue what it's about.
All right. So The Midnight Gospel is an animated show that is on Netflix. And this is where I'll get your interest straight away. It's created by a comedian called Duncan Trussell, and also by Pendleton Ward.
Okay.
Yeah. The animation of it is, there's a lot of Adventure Time in there. There's some Rick and Morty. I feel like they're kind of the two like specific areas that it pulls from. But basically,
don't forget Bravest Warriors, by the way. I want to shout out Cat Bug as well. He's a cat and he's a bug.
Naturally. The extension of Cat Doug. Yeah. So yeah, the show itself is basically, it's kind of like a visual tour de force that is pulling material from a podcast called the Duncan Trussell Family Hour that's been going on for a number of years now. And basically, Duncan Trussell has a variety of guests and like comedians and people in that kind of field. And they talk very like high level philosophy, existentialism, space, drugs, all this kind of just like big, like weighty topics. And they just shoot the shit. You know, they talk about it, their experiences, what they think. And like, I've listened to a little bit of the podcast, and it's very hard to do anything else while listening to that, because it's just, you know, it goes places. It really explores places. But effectively, just it's that, but Pendleton Ward has created a cartoon around it that is a mixture of, and this is only going by the first episode, but it's a mixture of the people on the podcast talking, and then whatever kind of environment that Pendleton Ward has set up that fits, or to be quite honest, doesn't fit what they're talking about. So the first episode, actually, I'll give you the synopsis so you can understand just like how mental this show is. The Midnight Gospel revolves around a space caster named Clancy Gilroy, who lives on the Chromatic Ribbon, a membranous tape-like planet situated in the middle of a colorful void where simulation farmers use powerful bioorganic computers to simulate a variety of universes from which they harvest natural resources and new technology. So, you know.
Sure. Yeah, that's a thing.
That's a David Bowie album from the 70s.
I was going to say, Pendleton Ward, like, the stuff that he's getting involved in, because Adventure Time is weird, right?
Yes.
Bravest Warriors was, if anything, weirder. This sounds even weirder than both of them.
I would hazard a bet that it probably is. So to give you a little bit of kind of context for what the first episode is, the main character, Clancy, he has this device that lets him kind of simulate or travel to one of, you know, infinite multiverses, and he picks a specific version of Earth that he goes to because there's a guy with glasses that he wants to meet and talk to. He teleports himself to that version of Earth where he meets this person who turns out to be the president of this particular planet, who is also currently dealing with a zombie apocalypse. But they are so nonplussed about the apocalypse at all times. Like, the president is just like firing and shooting, you know, zombies left, right, and center, while just having this casual conversation about drugs with Clancy. And I think it's the kind of show that you need to watch three times. You need to watch once where you just watch the visuals, once where you just listen to what they're talking about, and then the third time where you try and put it together. Because there were so many times in, I think the episode's about half hour long, there are so many times when I was watching what was going on that I completely lost track of what they were talking about. And then there were times what they were talking about, I completely lost track of what I was watching, because you cannot channel the two things at the same time, because they're firing through all of this. The best way I can describe it, you know, like when Bill Hicks would have his big kind of philosophical like monologues at the end about it's just a ride, and you get on the roller coaster and it goes up and down. It's like that, but it's spread over half an hour and it's 10 times faster and packs in 10 times as much to try and process.
Sidebar, somebody wrote like the it's just a ride thing out on one of the toilet walls in the electric ballroom in Camden.
Incredible.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yep.
And like one of the key things that I did pick up was the idea they were talking about how drugs have been like transformed basically into there are bad drugs and there are good drugs. And they were trying to explain that that's not the case at all. There are basically drugs, and then depending on the use for them and the context of them, that is what determines whether it's a good or a bad drug, which is, you know, there are some things you could say for and against that, but it was just basically, here is a thing and here's, you know, what I'm saying, and let's explore that as a concept. Which,
so not a kid's show then, really?
Not a kid's show, no, absolutely not at all. And visually, it's not a kid's show as well. You know, like, there are zombies getting blown to shit, there are people getting eaten, but it's done such in a surrealist kind of way that it's not, you know, it's not body horror. It's not like graphically, it's not horrifying, basically. It's just, it's fucking mental. I've only watched one episode of it. It's the closest, it's cliche to say, but it is the closest I've ever felt to being on drugs, which I kind of think just from the color palette, the visual design and the context of what they're talking about, I want to say that is partially the intended design. And there's very few times that I've watched something and just come away and just had to sit there and not think about anything else for 10 minutes. You know, it's intense, but in a really cool kind of way. And I really want to watch the rest of it, but I feel like it's the kind of thing that I just need to mentally cleanse myself and prepare for, and then make sure I've got nothing planned afterwards, because it goes places literally and figuratively.
You're kind of making it sound like the cartoon version of what it's like to watch a Black Mirror episode.
To some degree, yeah. Not that
the tone of the shows is the same. It's just like, I could, you know, I hear about people binging Black Mirror. I'm like, Jesus Christ, I watch an episode of Black Mirror. I need at least half an hour just to myself afterwards. So.
Yeah. It's. I think it's got a little bit of that in the way you describe. It's really cool. I want to try and watch the rest of it soon, but again, it's just the kind of thing that I don't think I could watch this all in one go, but it's definitely, even if you just watch the first episode, because I think the first episode, without having watched the rest of it, I think it does still at least give a pretty clear indicator of like, all right, this is what this is the ride that you're settling in for. So if you're not on board with the first episode, I probably can't imagine the rest of it would work for you. But again, it's Pendleton Ward, and like, you can, even before I knew that it was him, I could just see his fingerprints all over this. And I think something that's actually really interesting is, like, I was making the comparison with Rick and Morty, and like, Rick and Morty, a lot of its theme and its message, there's a lot of nihilism in Rick and Morty, and sometimes,
yep, that'll be Dan Harmon.
Yeah, I know, right? And actually, Dan Harmon's on this podcast. I don't know if he's on this show itself, but like, I was scrolling through like the list of guests, and Dan Harmon does appear at a point. And there are times when I can't deal with it. And but Rick and Morty kind of gets away with it because it's overloaded with such just absurd like images and concepts and stories that the nihilism is kind of baked in underneath sometimes, but sometimes it also just like really shows itself up front, and it's just like, all right, fine, whatever. But The Midnight Gospel, and again, I've only watched the one episode, but even with this zombie apocalypse that's going on, there's no kind of trace of that. It's just real kind of big open conversation, and you know, I feel there's a lot of kind of spirituality going on, and you know, again, a lot of kind of philosophy, and it's just, I don't know, there's something very engaging that I was immediately drawn to with it, in a way that I don't always get with Rick and Morty. And this is coming from someone whose favorite album for the longest time is The Holy Bible by Manic Street Preachers. I understand this. but yeah, it's just, I've really been drawn to it, even with this one episode. So yeah, I'd like other people to watch it and tell me what they think.
I mean, you want to talk about nihilism, Holy Bible, my word.
It is about the peak of it, let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, man, that sounds interesting. It does sound like something that at some stage I definitely would check out. I like the other stuff that Pendleton Ward has done. I'm not a drugs guy. I never have been. I am very CM Punk in my approach to drugs and alcohol, for anyone that knows me. So, yeah, that'll be interesting. A trip where you don't have to actually take drugs it sounds like a safe experience.
Anyway. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Moving on to what we've been playing, and I'll start with you, Jack. What has been your playing experiences in the last 2 weeks? I guess since.
Yeah, I guess so. The kind of the headline is nothing new, so I don't want to go through any kind of rehashed territory. Dipping back into Hitman because of the garden party stuff, which was a lot of fun. They basically completely transformed the sort of creepy murder mystery mansion level in Dartmoor into a brilliant like garden party full of self-important assholes showing off terrible exhibitions to each other. And yeah, that's a lot of fun to be playing. I took my Nintendo Switch with me on a long train journey I had recently, and on the way back because it just seems like Barry has coaxed it out of everybody, played some Super Mario Sunshine, and had a bit of a fun time with that. And by fun, I mean partially fun, partially frustrating as hell. I've been carrying on playing Pokemon Go, and the Ultra Unlocks and stuff in Pokemon Go, and just generally things that I've spoken about quite a bit before. So I don't necessarily want to hash into any of that territory. So I see that you have got two relatively unspoken about things on the Heath. So I'll let you dig into those.
Well, so I spoke a fair bit about Death's Door last week, and I'm coming up towards the end of it now. I'm about 10 hours in or so. And actually about 10 hours, maybe a little bit less, but I streamed a bunch of it last week. And yeah, I think I'm kind of coming up towards the end now, and I really, really like it. The main issue that I still have with it that I explored last week is that it doesn't really do puzzles. Like the puzzles that are there are just there in front of you, and they're more obstacle based than like logic based. So there's like a room where you've got these four pillars and you've got a hookshot. And depending on like how you raise or lower the pillars determines like the level that you're on that you can hookshot over to the next thing to get, like, there's a key at the highest point.
And that kind of sounds a bit like the water temple.
The difference is, though, is because like the water temple, and I think I was explaining this last week, like a lot of the time, especially with the water temple, you'll raise the water, which gives you access to a different part of the temple, but you have no idea where in the temple that's going to be. And Mark Brown's series on like Boss Keys, he does a really good job explaining about this, about how it really gets you to understand the relationship between like you and the dungeon, and really gets you to understand, like, you know, okay, I've been over here, I know I can do X, Y, and Z. If I raise or lower the water, that will allow me to progress further. But the game never telegraphs and says, hey, you've done this here, that has now made that happen over there. And Death's Door doesn't really do that. Like, if you change something, it either immediately shows you with a camera cut, so like, hey, this is the gate that you've opened, or it moves the camera over there, or just the thing happens right in front of you. So there's maybe like a 5% element of what you're talking about. And you know, a lot of Death's Door clearly is inspired by the likes of Zelda. I mean, there are dungeons, so that just that crossover, yeah, that parallel happens one way or the other. But I think there's, you know, there's a fair amount of Zelda.
Inspired by Zelda is definitely not the worst thing a video game could say about itself.
No. And I don't think it ever, because, and again, I think I mentioned this, like, that I've played so many Zelda-like games over the last couple of years, usually a lot of like the 2D top-down pixel art style ones, that are so enamored and wearing its influences in its sleeves that it just doesn't have its own identity. Because either the puzzles, I know exactly what's coming because I've seen them before, or it just doesn't have anything original about it, which is one of the reasons that I loved CrossCode so much last year, because it was the first time in ages that I played a 2D top-down game that was obviously, you know, Zelda-inspired, but it went off and did its own thing, and I actually really want to play through that again. And Death's Door is kind of the same. That again, it's doing the 3D but isometric view, so on its own makes it a little bit different. But yeah, the key issue that I've had is just I haven't been stuck on any part of the game. I haven't really had to scratch my head and think about like the logic of, okay, what is it that you want me to do here? Everything is just, it's there in front of you. It's very easy to just, you know, even by brute force, you're going to figure out even the most taxing puzzle that there is to try and understand. And the only kind of real challenge that the game provides you is there are secrets. So there are like parts of the environment that are hidden off because the way the camera is set up, it's a fixed camera. So you might have like a wall that you can go around, but there's nothing to clearly telegraph that, hey, you can go around this wall. You just kind of have to go try it and see it. And then the camera will switch around to show you like, hey, here's a secret that you found. So it does a lot of that. And just a lot of like, you know, walls that might be able to explode that you didn't know could explode previously. That's kind of the crux of it. So, and there is a fair amount of that. Like there are four key like items that you pick up. And every time you pick one up, there's usually some area in the last area that you was in that can use that weapon. There's like a fire projectile, there's an arrow, there's the hook shot, and there's bombs. So naturally, you know, there are a ton of breakable walls that you can't do anything with until you're like 50, 60% of the way through the game. And then as soon as you get the bombs, you're like, okay, well, now I can go back. And the good thing about it is you do get, even if it's just like the currency in the game, you do get rewarded for going back to check these things. And it has a very kind of small RPG element to it. So like the main central hub of the game, you can upgrade your melee, your ability to avoid attacks faster, your ranged attacks can be more powerful. So, you know, there is incentive to go back and track these things. You can increase your vitality and your like magic meter as well. So all of that's really good. And all the environments are really fun to explore. It's a, without being a detailed game in terms of its level of artistic splendor, it's very, just the animation is incredibly smooth. Everything's very slick. I haven't run into any issues frame rate wise. I think it's running at a very smooth 60 frames per second. But again, it's not particularly graphically intensive. So like, I don't have the most powerful graphics card in the world, but I've got everything whacked up to high and I haven't run into a single issue. But the game also doesn't allow to have too much on the screen at one time. So it never runs into an issue where it could run into that level of slowdown where like the ascent, it can pack a lot of shit on the screen in one go and the game struggles to deal with it. But I know they put a patch out this week, so I'll be curious to check that out and see how that's handled it. But yeah, I really like the Death Store. I think that at no point would I say it's completely wowed me, but it's done so many little things. I'm like, yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. I really like the writing. You know, story-wise, it's not the focus of the game, but the characters and the brief amount of time that you have with some of the characters in the game, it's made me laugh a couple of times. So, and I mentioned that it has a little bit of Psychonauts in its writing and its tone, which isn't immediately apparent, but you kind of see it over time with some of the characters. So that gets a thumbs up from me. And it's, you know, some of the soundtrack is really good as well. So yeah, Death Store is a really cool game. And I don't think it's on Switch. Maybe it is. I don't know where it's been released, but if it's on Switch, it's the perfect game for Switch. And I'd really give it a strong recommendation. So yeah, Death Store. I will probably have this finished. Maybe not this weekend because I'm back in England next week, but hopefully before next week, I'll have it finished.
Yeah, man. Shout out Acid Nerve as well, a small studio in the UK from Manchester who made the game. Pretty cool.
Yeah, if I'm correct, they made Titan Souls as well. Yep. And I fucking love Titan Souls because it's basically my favorite type of game, which is just give me a bunch of bosses and let me die over and over and over again. But unlike Bloodborne, it gives me good combat. So, yeah.
I mean, that's just shots fired at Sean McGee, isn't it? You already lost him last week by having Barry on, so...
Oh, good. It means he's not listening, so I can say what I want.
I think we need to get him on soon for a rebuttal here.
Yeah, you're probably right. The other thing that I've sunk only about an hour, maybe 2 hours into, is Axiom Verge 2. Now, I know... Sorry, Jack.
I was going to say, I did not know Axiom Verge 2 was coming out. I've been blindsided by this.
Yeah, it shadow dropped with their direct about a week and a half ago. And I for some reason thought it was coming out next year just because most games are coming out next year at this point. So yeah, they were just like, hey, Axiom Verge 2 out now. Oh, right. Okay. Well, I'm going to get my hands on that.
Because the first one was kind of a big deal, right? People really liked the first one.
To some degree, yeah. I think like... Metroidvanias, I don't want to say it's hard to fuck up, but Metroidvanias usually, if you get at least a fair amount of it right, there's an experience to be had there that is enjoyable. And we've, you know, we're I don't want to say we're living through like the golden age or the silver age of Metroidvanias, but we've had some really good ones over the past 5 to 10 years with Guacamelee, Hollow Knight, Ori, and Axiom Verge, the original, and I think it was the original Ori came out within a relatively similar span of time. And I didn't play the original Ori at the time, because I didn't have an Xbox One. Yes. But I did get Axiom Verge because that was just more available. I think I played that on my Switch, if I recall. And I thought it was pretty good. It didn't wow me in the same way that a Hollow Knight or a Guacamelee did, but I think that it did a better job of portraying a world kind of similar to the likes of a Metroid. You know, it's very futuristic and you know, slightly cyberpunkish, I guess, in its tone. And it went in a slightly different direction with its story as well, I guess, which I can commend it for, because a lot of, I think of like Hollow Knight, and Hollow Knight isn't so much about the story. Hollow so much is just about the world itself that it builds, which is the appeal of Hollow Knight. But Ori is just very much like, hey, the light in the forest has gone out, go turn the light back on again, which it somehow does for two games in a row. But it's beautiful, so I don't care. But with Axiom Verge, yeah, it's, and certainly with this one, like the immediate vibe, and they've made a really good shout out that there's a lot of John Carpenter's The Thing in here. There's a very, like, it's I think it's based on Antarctica. It has that Arctic exploration. There are these abandoned bases that you have to go into, and it's very dark.
Looking at screenshots, it kind of reminds me of Hoth from Star Wars.
Yeah, actually, yeah. It's got a little bit of that. Yeah, definitely the... I think Hoth is in the Super Nintendo Star Wars game. I haven't played that game in fucking eons. But yeah, it's got a little bit of that. And actually, graphically in general, it very much looks like a 16-bit era game. I'd imagine there are some back-end tricks going on that couldn't have happened at the time, but it's following a similar palette. And it's... So far, it hasn't grabbed me. Now, partially, that's because I'm trying to juggle about six different games at the same time. So I've only had so much time to give to one particular game in general. And I'm hoping, I sent my Joy-Con off to get fixed because it was having the drift. I'm hoping I get it back before I fly over next week so I can spend a bit more time playing it.
You mean Bowser's fixing it for you?
Yeah, Bowser's fixing it. Thanks for that, Bowser.
If anyone hasn't seen it, go to Mark's Twitter, plug your Twitter handle.
At Lithium Project. Yes, I got a very nicely worded email from Nintendo/Bowser. Telling me, hey, we're sending your Joy-Con back.
Basically, the email with Bowser standing next to it, like as a giant speech bubble. I just like the idea that if you sent your Joy-Con off to Nintendo, it's a different Mario character fixing it every time. I just keep sending mine there and hoping that Roy would one day fix my Joy-Con, my Roy-Con.
It is the dream, isn't it? Oh, Roy-Con. Oh, my God.
It's right there, isn't it? Man. They need to make Roy Joy-Cons. I'm a sucker. I would itself. Buy them. I would it buy them right away. Itself. Yeah.
But yeah, way off topic there. And partially, I'm not surprised it's off topic because, again, nothing about this game has grabbed me yet. It's. I will say this, any Metroidvania game that gets you into the game very quickly, gets you picking up different abilities that lets you traverse the environment a lot quicker, I'm all for, because it just opens up the world a lot quicker and doesn't keep you stifled in one area for a while. But otherwise, I just don't have much to say about it yet. And
is it because of what you were mentioning, though? You mentioned the sort of new golden age, silver age, or whatever for Metroidvanias. So therefore, you've played quite a lot of them in the last little while. So this one would be a good one that you enjoy, but it doesn't really stand out from the others. So like maybe if you hadn't had that experience of playing so many in the last little while, you'd enjoy it more? Or do you generally just think it's because it's a good, not great game?
I can't say yet because I'm only an hour in. But the inherent issue that is very hard to overcome with Metroidvanias is that it does take a few hours to really get into the groove of it. And that's kind of what I said about it. It's crucial that, you know, within the first hour, players have the ability to get moving around and you know, they're not just kind of stifled with like the basic abilities. And Axiom Verge has nailed that bit down, but I do think it's partially just I need to get a few more hours into the game and get my groove with the combat and the enemies and the overall kind of world to explore, because it's just part and parcel of the Metroidvania design. There are very few games that can't get around that, like even Hollow Knight, which I did a fucking 110% run of that game at the start of the year. And even that, which has become one of my favorite games of the last generation, even that can't get around the fact that for that first hour, 2 hours, you're kind of just, you have like a critical path that you can follow. You can't really go off of that path because you don't have the abilities yet. But once you get to the city of tears, I think it's the city of tears, basically the rest of the world opens up, and then you have about 6 or 7 different ways that you can go to complete the rest of the game. So there's that, and the fact that I'm just not quite sure, like the game isn't kind of directing me in a specific way yet. So I don't know. I think I just need to spend a bit more time with it, but currently so far in that first hour, I like the setting, but there's nothing about it. There's nothing about it visually that's like, wow, in the same way that, you know, Guacamelee stands out. Like, it's got so much color and vibrancy about it.
Oh, I agree. I remember when I first watched you play Guacamelee, and I am not really a Metroidvania guy, but just seeing everything about how colorful, kinetic, and full of energy that game was made me want to play it.
Yeah.
I look at the screenshots of this game, and there's nothing that kind of stands out to me visually that make me want to play it. What would make me want to play it is if you told me that there was like a really interesting story or narrative kind of device that kind of drives the whole thing forward. So I guess as you get deeper into it, I'd be interested to see what they do and develop with the story.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it has a specific, like, the thing going on other than just the setting, but there is this sort of like parallel world that you go into, and that, you know, is the crux of the story within the first 5-10 minutes. That's what happens. There's not really spoilers there, but I guess I'm waiting to kind of see what the next plot beat is, because I'm still with that first plot beat. So yeah, hopefully I'll have more to talk about that in the upcoming weeks, but there's like fucking 4 or 5 new games that have dropped between the time this podcast has been recording and goes live. So, oh my God, we're really getting into the thick of it.
Getting heavy, yeah.
Yeah.
Been waiting for a lot of the year, to be fair, for some big releases, haven't we? So
we'll move on to the news. And there's really cool... There seems to have been like a whole bunch of new people. Not new people, but like different channels that have propped up in the last couple of years that have been doing some really good investigative journalism or like documentary pieces, obviously your Noclips. There's a series called People Makes Games. One of the guys in it, Quinton Smith, who used to be on another YouTube channel called Core Ghosts. I don't know if he's still doing it. I don't know actually if that channel's still active. But he was doing a video about Roblox, which... First of all, Roblox is fascinating because it is a monster in the games industry, but no one fucking knows about it because its base is primarily kids. You know, like Minecraft is now the core audience is that, I don't know, like 5 to 15 age demographic or whatever around that demographic. But before that, it was a game that our generation was playing, but it's kind of transitioned since.
I think Minecraft appeals, it's one of those broad things that appeals to everyone. It kind of has it is the sort of video game Lego effect, but it also has the broadness of Lego in like a cultural penetration. Like people that are like in their 40s, 50s will watch like Let's Plays of Minecraft or whatever on YouTube as much as people that are like 5, 6 would watch it.
Yeah, and Roblox is coming... come along after that, or our generation, I guess. So it was always a thing that I've heard of, but I didn't actually know really what it was, other than just a lot of young kids were playing it and it was making a shit ton of money. But Quinton Smith, he did the video that's really worth watching about Roblox's exchange system, which it claims the video itself makes it incredibly hard for developers to make money from the platform. The video, which, you know, talks about Roblox, the platform itself has over 200 million monthly users and encourages young game developers to work incredibly hard with unreasonable expectations of success. The game itself is development tool. You know, it's a slightly, say, stripped down version of a Unity, whatever kind of game making tool you can think of, or like Dreams that's on PS4 and PS5. And people that make games with it, they can actually develop and monetize their games, all in a virtual currency called Robux. As the channel points out, though, getting your game noticed among the millions available on the platform is incredibly difficult, but you can use Robux. They have like an ad slot or like an auction for ads system in the game, which is not that dissimilar from how ads work in other platforms as well, but it's incredibly shady that it is being used in this platform, which is basically just about, you know, getting kids to make games. And now they're being asked to effectively gamble on like being able to get an ad for their game, you know, noticed to the degree that they can actually make any sort of money from it. If any Robux user wants to turn their Robux into real money, the minimum withdrawal amount is 100,000 Robux, which is worth $1,000. This increases the chances a Robux developer will not hit that cap and plow the money back into Roblox. Meanwhile, creators cannot withdraw any Robux unless they first pay for a Roblox monthly premium subscription. And as PMG, the channel, points out, Roblox buys Robux from users at a different rate than sells them. So 100,000 Robux gets you $350.
Immediately shady, right?
Yeah. So this system was compared to like historical mining and logging camps paying workers in company scripts. There was a thing as well. I don't think it's in here, but so basically one of the big issues as well is the fact that you've got big debate going on now between Epic and Apple, and like, you know, Steam have been involved as well about, you know, what is the fair point, the cutoff point in terms of how much the developer gets and how much the platform holder gets. And with Apple is, I think it's like 30 or 40%. I can't remember the exact number. Steam, I think, is around that. The Epic Store is about 12%. But with Roblox, it is 75% goes to the platform.
Wow.
Which, and then there's some other kind of things as well in there.
Considering that most of the people creating the user content on there are young, that is incredibly exploitative.
It is quite insidious, yeah. So yeah, there's more stuff in here, and I would just say that like it's really worth watching the video, and Eurogamer have an article basically explaining what the video is about. But this is because Roblox, it's one of those things where the game itself or the platform, whatever you want to call it, is so incredibly popular, but has gone under the radar to, you know, the quote unquote sort of mainstream gaming audience, because it's not a AAA game. It's not on a AAA platform. It's just this kind of thing off doing its own thing in its own ecosphere. It's really gone under the radar, but I'm very happy that it has come to light and that the Quentin Smith has kind of done this video, because it's not a thing that I would have known about. And it's not a thing that I think people would have been aware of that they should be aware of, whether it be, you know, they have a kid who's trying to make something using this platform or whatever the case may be. And there's, you know, some real shady exploitative stuff going on. And this is like a public traded company now, you know, I can't remember. I saw the numbers recently, but in terms of, you know, money being generated, like Roblox is way up there in the stratosphere. And how much of it is because of these shady practices, you know, remains to be seen. I'm sure the numbers are there, but it's a really interesting, shocking in some ways, read and watch, and I'd really recommend it.
Yeah, I think I definitely will watch that. Like you described, Mark, my knowledge of what happens in the sort of Roblox universe and with Robux is pretty much non-existent. So yeah, the 75% thing is a massive red flag, though, a huge red flag that things aren't quite right there. By the way, sidebar, the OnlyFans thing this week is blowing my mind. The fact that OnlyFans are going to kind of go straight and not have any adult content on there, when pretty much you would say the entire notoriety and knowledge of the platform is built around people that make adult content and publish it on there, and it's a safe way for them to do that and earn money from people, and people have built businesses and stuff on there, and to get investment from banks, they've decided to take the one fundamental element that kind of people know them for and shut it down. So
yeah,
an odd one, right?
There was an article that I saw, I think it was yesterday, I think it was The Verge, or it was one of those kind of like tech haven sites. And from what I was seeing, one of the reasons, or maybe the primary reason that they have decided to take this step, is that a lot of the content that was getting posted was, you know, either not legal, whether it be like revenge porn or anything kind of that nature. And I'm thinking that OnlyFans decided to do this, basically, A, because they didn't want to open themselves up to a lawsuit, and B, as someone who has done a level of content moderation as part of his current job and prior jobs, the amount of man hours and like actual human resources that you need to do that kind of thing, it's just not feasible. And we are nowhere near the level where, and you know, there are tools in place to try and detect that sort of thing, but as with anything, when you use AI, there's usually some level of unconscious bias in there where you know, whether it be LGBTQ creators on YouTube getting flagged automatically for whatever reason that they shouldn't be, that, you know, it's completely valid, perfectly legal content, that kind of thing runs amok very quickly. And I think that OnlyFans just decided that they just, the easier way to go with this is just to scrap that part of that platform, which, yes, obviously,
that'll kill their whole business. Though.
Probably kill their whole business, but they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, where it's over that, or they have to, you know, invest God knows how many millions into trying to do that. And it's probably just, it's not worth the hassle. Yeah. Like, I know people that have worked for Facebook and worked for YouTube in content moderation or around the area. And it's just, because it's not only just the amount of the man hours that you need to do that, but it's also, you can't just have them sit in front of a screen for 8 hours taking down content, because a fair amount of that content is very troublesome to watch. It can be very graphic. It can be very distressing. So not only do you have to employ someone to do that, you then have to, and I don't know if it's by law, but I know that it was happening, again, for people I know working in that part of the industry, you have to provide psychological resources and counseling, and they have to take breaks like every 2 hours and all this kind of shit. And again, I would imagine that OnlyFans, A, don't have the resources in place. Well, they probably have the money to do it at this point, but they just have no idea how to structure it. And it's probably just, there's too much work involved and they can't be bothered to it. So they just, fuck it, we'll just scrap it and hedge our bets that we can still have a viable platform without the adult content.
Nope.
We will see. But yes, I would imagine they will probably fall on their faces. But I can't say that I blame them for taking this route. It obviously, naturally, it sucks for people that are using that platform. And I know that, you know, there's been 100 articles about like people making a decent living off of OnlyFans. And, you know, I'm all for the support of sex work and people making money that way. But I can also see, obviously, there is the other side of it with content that is being posted that shouldn't be up there. And yeah, this is the route that OnlyFans have taken. Now, if that is the exact reason, I'm sure there's a number of factors involved, but I imagine that is a piece of the puzzle that, you know, when the news was breaking, everyone obviously just went, well, this is stupid. You know, they're just going to go under. But like with anything, there's usually a couple of other factors involved, and that is one that maybe people aren't aware of. And this is also way the fuck off topic, but it is interesting. And I think some people might be overlooking that aspect of that particular story.
Yeah. Sorry. I was just thinking about user generated content and stuff. And I know OnlyFans cut is like 20%. So like, that's relatively reasonable kind of against the weight of some of the other things. And yeah, it was just when you mentioned that 75% cut for Roblox, I was like, well, I saw the article the other day and just thought it was like a really interesting direction for them to move in. But yeah, sorry. Let's move back onto Pokemon, Mark.
Yeah.
from OnlyFans to Pokemon, which is like, some people choose to spend their money on OnlyFans. I choose to spend my money on Pokemon.
Yeah, so we had a new Pokemon Presents on Wednesday, which naturally had news about the Diamond and Pearl remakes, Legends Arceus. But there was also a couple of other things in here. So we'll go through these one by one so I can kind of get some of your takes on some of this stuff. Pokemon Unite is heading to mobile in September, September the 22nd specifically for Android and iOS, with the mobile version having cross-play with the Switch version as well. And two more playable Pokemon coming being Mamoswine and Sylveon. Have you checked out Pokemon Unite yet at all?
Have I played it? No. Have I watched footage of it and seen other people play it? Yes. It does kind of just look like a MOBA.
It is just a MOBA.
and it looks like a kind of, you know, Insidious one in terms of, like, if you want to buy into this, that, and the other thing, you can, like, buy outfits and all sorts of stuff. And that just, it's just, you know, I've already dabble in Pokemon-based microtransactions by investing money in Pokemon Go from time to time, and I don't want to hook myself onto another one because I know it would be quite easy for me to do it. So I'm kind of avoiding Pokemon Unite, to be honest with you. So, yeah.
I think I will at least... I will give it a glancing look on my phone. But I could care less for MOBAs. So I imagine it's one of those things that I will download, I will play around and go, yep, that's Pokemon Unite, and then never look at it again. So, but hey, it's got crossplay, which I think is obviously, it goes without saying, that is crucial. I don't know what the install base has been for the Switch version, but, and to be honest, I haven't really heard a lot of people talking about it, but, you know, that's kind of MOBA games in general. So, yeah, we've got Pokemon Cafe Remixed, which is so Pokemon Cafe was a year ago, two years ago, and it's this kind of cute little, like, it's a cute little mobile game. You run a cafe and, you know, you can make different meals and stuff, and it's getting a remixed version which has new puzzle elements, additional Pokemon, and new dress up options. And the Pokemon themselves are now finally allowed to eat. I had it for a couple of days. I quite enjoyed it. It was a charming little thing. I barely remember that much about it, but I'll probably pick it up again and see what the remix version is, play it for a few days, and then not look at it again.
It was fun.
I really like the art style of it.
Yeah, the art style is beautiful. Like, it's super cute. Like, if I was, like, you know, sort of 10 years old, I think I'd love this game, invest probably a lot more time in it. But yeah, it was cool. Like, the, you know, you can cook different meals and upgrade your cafe, and it's kind of got that sort of owning a business element to it. Like, a sort of, like, it's a really kind of weak in terms of connection to, like, a business management sim, I would say. And it's much more about the art style and the sort of general warm feeling you get of playing the game. And yeah, I will probably check this out as well. And I'd imagine I'll spend an hour or two with it, which is exactly what I spent with Pokemon Cafe in the first place.
So yeah, the remix of Diamond and Pearl, both being updated but still faithful to the originals, will feature the originals mini games like the Pokemon Super Contest, the Underground with the Dowsing mini game, and a secret base. Players will now also be able to customize their trainer's outfit, which, to be quite honest, we should have had, I don't know, 15 fucking years ago at this point. So we finally
In the new ones, though, can't you?
It's still pretty limited, I want to say. But I imagine part of that is, you know, Nintendo's, like, user content mechanics. They probably want to keep limited because, you know, there's less chance of a dick being drawn on a t-shirt, which I understand to some degree. And even
so basically, Mark, what you're saying is you've been waiting 15 years to draw a dick on your Pokemon characters t-shirt.
But I'm sure there are people that have.
It's okay, Mark. Like, I understand. It's funny. Like, the comedy cock and balls, like, you know, exactly.
And even Pokeballs will now have collectible stickers that can add visual effects to throw animations.
See, now this I thought was really cool, the Pokeball element. Like, I could care less about drawing a dick on my t-shirt, although I probably will.
You want to draw a dick on a Pokeball?
Exactly, yeah. No, I thought that was quite cool, the being able to customize the Pokeball and then throwing it out and the different animations. But it's all just kind of chuffer, really, isn't it? All these little things that they've added to it. Like, they're nice.
Most importantly and crucially for you, there are Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl Switch-like consoles featuring Dialga and Palkia.
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm going to try and stay away from this because they are only Switch Lite and I already have a Switch Lite.
Can you just walk me through, like, what are the special edition consoles that you've owned in your years?
I have a Pokemon Switch Lite here. I had, like, the Pikachu Pokemon DS. 2DS. I have, like, a special edition 3DS XL for, I think it was Sun and Moon, And I think I have like another special edition Pokemon 3DS somewhere as well. I got at least four 3DSs, and two of them are Pokemon, and a 2DS, which is also Pokemon.
But purely Nintendo centric, you've never had like a Metal Gear Solid PlayStation?
I weirdly have a Gears of War Xbox One.
I feel like I vaguely remember you telling me about that.
Yeah, so Gears of War 5 Xbox One, that's kind of like red, and it's got like battle scars and bullet holes and stuff in it. Don't even tell me why. I wanted to buy an Xbox One at the time, and there were two versions out. There was that, and there was the like, this is a super limited edition, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you know what? I might as well just get this. The same way I got like the Destiny PlayStation 4 that's like pure white as well.
Can you tell me, like, genuinely that you've booted up the Xbox One more than, say, 50 times?
I boot up every day because I put my TV through it.
Ah, right.
So okay. It's a way of, like, having your TV that goes through it and not having to then plug a TV and an Xbox One into the back of your TV. You can plug the TV into the Xbox One and into the TV, which is pretty cool. And then I usually watch Netflix and all of the like Disney Plus and stuff on there as well. Okay. So I don't really play a lot of games on it. The games I'll play on like the S, if I want to play an Xbox game, and all of the stuff that I do with it is usually basically use it like an entertainment center rather than a games
which
console.
Is what they originally designed it around, and you know, sure. Like failed spectacularly.
Exactly.
Game Freak showed off how Pokemon battles will work in Pokemon Legends Arceus, a definite variation on the battles we're all familiar with. When battles begin, players will have a few different style options for battling in a turn-based fashion. So I've seen there are like screen grabs of like strong style and agile style, which sure, I pop sure. for, yep. Which is, you know, I never thought I would see fucking Yakuza. The Yakuza battle system make its way into Pokemon, but here we are.
Immediately thought Shinsuke Nakamura.
Naturally, away. That as well. Which change statistics on specific moves, depending on situations. Likewise, some Pokemon may be able to take a few turns in a row based on their statistics. The turn-based mechanics definitely look familiar, but the changes look intriguing.
Before you finish that,
yeah.
The immediate pop was when you switch between strong and agile style, it basically has in the top right what can only be described as the combat meter or the combat sort of like ordering system from Final Fantasy X, where you see your Pokemon and the other Pokemon and how many turns there are. And it will show you like the next six or seven turns so you can plan out your attacks, which is so fucking cool. And it's one of the best things about Final Fantasy X is that battle system, being able to know when you're in a battle, right, this is what I'm doing, so you can plan ahead what you're doing. So you've got like a battle chess type situation, which, you know, in a Pokemon game, it's just normally turn versus turn versus turn versus turn, like unless you've got a slacking and it's like every other turn or whatever. So I really, really like the look of that. I just wanted to chuck that in there, sorry. Before
it's going to be really weird to play a Pokemon game that has, you know, we've had like little twists here and there, but the core crux, as you mentioned there, is it's just kind of turn-based, turn, and every now and again you can turn your Pikachu into a fucking 50-foot like Godzilla-esque type thing. But here, yeah, like it's throwing the mechanics up in a way that I wonder how that's going to impact a lot of people that have been playing Pokemon games for the last 30 years or so, you know?
Yeah, well, it's just different, isn't it? And the fact that your player can take damage as well, like wild Pokemon can like start fucking you up, basically, I quite enjoyed. Because it's funny, like you walk around, you know, all of the wild areas that they put into the Sword and Shield. And, you know, you're walking past like a really mean looking Pokemon, like say like a Mamoswine or something. And it's like staring at you with its like dead eyes. And you know that it wants to just summon a massive blizzard attack and sort of bury you in the snow. But it can't, because it can only do that when you get your own Pokemon out. So the fact that you're now walking around and Pokemon can attack or whatever, and you've got to be careful and hide in grass. And yeah, I just think it's a really interesting take on what a Pokemon game is. And they haven't done anything fresh like this for a long, long time. Everything I've seen from this Arceus game looks really innovative.
It also really kind of hones in, like, the obvious comparisons that were made when we had the initial trailer was Breath of the Wild, because there are a lot of visual elements that are very similar. But with some of these mechanical implementations as well, and this added level of survival that's been included, those Breath of the Wild comparisons have been increased quite a lot. So
yeah,
I will say that I still feel the game is visually lacking. I saw like a side-by-side comparison of like a big open forested area in a game from 10 years ago and what this is. And, you know, a lot of Pokemon games or a lot of Nintendo games, it's very much art direction over art content, I guess. But it does still feel like it is lacking to some degree. And this is a game that's coming out in about 4 or 5 months' time. So they still got plenty of time to...
Lacking or slacking?
It is slacking to some degree. But obviously it's not the finished product yet. So we'll see if they add a few more trees between now and then.
I don't necessarily feel like I need it to be this knockout, amazing visual killer of a game. I just don't. I just want it to be what it looks like, which is a new take on what a Pokemon RPG action adventure game can be, and that is exactly what it looks like. So it doesn't have to be winning any visuals or best style awards and stuff like that. It just has to be interesting. And you know what I'd really like is a bit of characterization and some interesting characters within game, maybe a story that kind of you can not necessarily buy into, but like has a bit of significance and a bit of weight to it as well, would be nice. Not holding my breath for that, but everything I've seen makes me excited. But maybe that's because I'm a mark for Pokemon.
Most crucially, there is a regional variant of Growlithe, and he is the goodest boy.
This was my ending point. I would happily go to war for this new Growlithe with his big fuzzy head. I just want to be friends with him and immediately get him on my team and have him run around and follow me with his like enthusiastic little grin. This new Growlithe is the greatest thing I've seen all year. So just going to throw that one out there.
Goodest boy 2022 already wrapped up.
Oh, sewn up. I don't even want to hear it.
Moving on, some of the people behind indie hit Among Us have spoken about Fortnite's new Imposters mode. So earlier this week, Fortnite developer Epic announced a new game mode for its all-encompassing battle royale that has an uncanny resemblance to 2018's online multiplayer game Among Us.
So, Mark, what you're saying is Fortnite took a concept from another game and they're going to monetize it and probably make it even bigger. Is that what you're saying?
I think in a roundabout way, yes, that is exactly what
because
I'm saying.
Because that is brand new information. Yeah. That has never happened before.
Imposters sees 10 players, 8 agents, and 2 imposters play out their roles in a submarine. Like in Among Us, the agents carry out routine assignments while the imposters sabotage the facility and eliminate players. Imposters can also teleport players to cover their tracks and disable assignments. And just like Among Us, agents can call for a discussion at any time by finding and reporting an eliminated agent or interacting with the discussion panel. Yeah, it is pretty much the same thing to a T. So as news of the new mode spread online, some of the people behind Among Us expressed their disappointment on social media. Community director Victoria Tran, who's really cool, she's awesome, you should go follow her. She said it would be really cool to collab, haha, just sad indie hours right now. Then, like game mechanics, fine, those shouldn't be gatekept, but at the very least, even different themes or terminology make things more interesting. And yeah, I mean, like, really, it just, the level of comparison between the two, I think the fact that it's called Imposters alone, like, even before you get into the fact, because, yeah, you can't gatekeep and you shouldn't gatekeep. You shouldn't have, like, a copyright, you know, on any kind of game mechanic. I know that these things have happened and they'll happen in the future, whatever. But that's just the thing that you shouldn't, you know, you can't, I don't think you should be able to fucking have a copyright on, like, a genre of music, for example. But
remember when that patent troll a few years ago tried to copy the concept of podcasts?
Yes.
Like, that sort of shit does exist, and it's always rightfully slapped down by
people. Of course, and this will always happen. But, like, all right, fine. If you want to have an Among Us type mode in Fortnite, sure, like, go hell for leather. Like, as you mentioned there, fucking, you know, the reason Fortnite blew up is they took PUBG's Battle Royale and And then, yeah, the next thing you know, Ninja is in fucking Free Guy, unfortunately. You know, that's where we are now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just imposters, like, surely there's anything else. Like, how many people do you have in your fucking team that you can't come up with an original name for your Among Us clone mode? That's the thing that gets me more than anything else.
Yeah, I can't wait until, like, you've got, like, Fortnite FIFA that you can play in there as well. And then you've got, like, oh, Fortnite does first-person shooter. And then it basically just looks like Call of Duty, but with Fortnite graphics. What else are they going to take?
Yeah, and even, like, the programmer, Gary Porter, like, he was showing, like, kind of comparisons of the maps. And just the level of similarity, it is as close to a carbon copy as you can get. And it's, you know, so the Innesloth, the creators of Among Us, co-founder Marcus Bromander, took to Twitter to point out that the company did not patent Among Us mechanics because I don't think that leads to a healthy game industry. And then he also said, like, is it really that hard to put 10% more effort into putting your own spin on it, though? Responding to a Twitter user who pointed out the viability of patenting Mafia, the influential live party game that inspired Among Us, Bromander replied, if Warner Bros. Can patent a Nemesis system and Square can patent the ATB system, we could patent the TAR systems, for example. So, yeah. And actually, he also said the worst part is we've actively been trying to collab with them as well. A representative for Epic told Eurogamer this morning the company has no comment to share. So
shocking, really, isn't it?
And it's also just as well, because Epic have really been trying to make their stance about them being one of the good guys. Again, going back to everything about them and Apple and that whole fucking lawsuit. This doesn't really help them looking like they're one of us, you know?
No, it doesn't. I would say that these sort of terrible people are in fact among us, Mark, and Epic is real sus right now.
Very good, very good. Finally, to round up news this week, what is it? When did this start with football media, football clubs and their social media accounts really going hell for leather about making just the most preposterous fucking announcement videos for their new players? Like, I know, yeah, obviously social media is all the rage,
but I would say
it's really gone, like, to another level over the last year or so, I feel.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people just want to go viral, right? Every sports entity, be it football, the American sports, like, anything you can think of, they all have a social media person who's in their early 20s and wants to go viral and wants to create something. And I, you know what? It's just a bit of fun, isn't it? Some of them are cringy and some of them are awful. Like, you know, some of them are Alexis Sanchez playing piano at Manchester United or, like, you know, Tony Rudiger, like, you know, giving his shirt to a tiny child in a club shop. But some of them are fantastic. And the one you're about to describe, I was incredibly impressed by, I must say.
Yeah, Spanish La Liga club Real Betis announced the signing of Argentinian defender Germán Pezzella with a video called GTA 4 Real Betis Edition. In the video, the striker, there are some names here that I'm going to butcher, so we'll see what happens. Aitor Rabayo walks to the club stadium with Estadio Benito Villamarin with the camera aping the GTA perspective and with a walk befitting Nico Bellic himself. The music is a good fit and is even a GTA style user interface complete with a mini map. The clip begins by referencing one of the most popular memes ever, the "Oh shit, here we go again" meme taken from San Andreas. And in the video, Rabayo says, "Oh boy, here we go again." He then enters the stadium and makes his way pitch side where he meets his new teammate, Guido Rodriguez. Rabayo hands Pezzella, who's standing nearby, a Real Betis shirt saying "Mission Pass signed," reads a text message using the GTA font. The video already has over 1.5 million views. So that is the sign that you've done your job.
There's some, like, 22-year-old Spanish kid right now just who's the absolute toast of Betis, right? He's fucking lording it right now. His 10 minutes of internet fame have peaked. I think it's great. Go to Real Betis Twitter account, everybody, and watch it. It's a really inventive way of kind of promoting your content.
The question I have from this, though, is, like, what is the next step? Where do we go from here? You know, I'm expecting some fucking Gears of War kind of collaboration in the next Gears of War game. Like, we have Batista and Gal 5, so what are we going to get for 6? I'm trying to think I'm trying to think, like, I'm trying to think of, like,
just give me Weasel. I just give me Weasel from the Suicide Squad.
I'm trying to think of, like, a real kind of bulked up player, like a Hulk or something. I think Hulk would be a good fit.
What for Gears of War 6?
Yeah.
Why is it about Gears of War, mate?
Because I don't know, like, I'm just imagining a football player in, like, the big kind of heavy armor.
I see.
Like, you know.
Yeah, no, I hear it. Do you know what would be good if you bought a couple of players at the same time and then you just set up the entire pitch and you have them like Tetris blocks making their way into position in the formation with the Tetris music in the background.
That's
and then you
good.
Can kind of go to them good. And then they all click into place and disappear and then reappear in the stands or something. That'd be pretty cool.
I'm trying to think as well, like, maybe you could have, like, a manager has a Pokeball and he throws it and captures whoever his new striker is or something.
Oh, my God. So, what? Well, yeah, you have, like, a manager, like, outside the old club that the player, plays for.
Yeah.
And then throws a Pokeball at him, captures him, and then throws it, like, in the middle of the new stadium. Yeah.
And imagine, like, Mourinho skulking around fucking outside Old Trafford or something. And
yeah. Trying to sign Luke Shaw. Yeah. Did you see, stuff like this, the GDA thing is so much better than like a really ridiculous 2.5 minute drone shot before a virtual Lionel Messi appears in the middle of the park.
I just found that whole thing. Well, I mean, the whole fucking Messi to PSG thing anyway, not to turn this into a
podcast. Let's not do that. But just like that, there are good and innovative and fun references, and there are absolutely terrible, like just over the top. Like, really, if you sign somebody of that notoriety, all you need to do is just have them in the shirt and go, this guy fucking plays here now, go buy a shirt, because that's really all you need. You don't need anything more than that. Whereas, you know, Betis, they need a bit of pop, you know? They need some people. They need some eyeballs on the product, and this might bring a few people in. Who knows?
Yeah, I found the whole messy thing to be a bit soulless and vapid and, you know, whatever else. But yes, this Real Betis, you won the internet that day, so congratulations. And we've got a few more days until the transfer window ends, so I would imagine most teams and their social media departments are on fucking overtime at the moment getting prepared for whatever nonsense. So this is not the end of it between now and the 31st of August, right?
That's, well, I mean, deadline. I'm now annoyed that I didn't get Romelu Lukaku dressed up like Kratos from God of War, like arriving on a boat down the River Thames.
That is very, like, good. That is very,
like,
good.
With like the Chaos Blades jumping out, you know, slicing up a few Fulham things, you know, as he makes his way all the way up to Stamford Bridge to like burst in the door. And it would have been good, is all I'm saying.
Just calling someone boy as he makes his way to the pitch.
Exactly. Yep.
Very good. On that interesting visual description, we're going to end it here for this week on this episode of Link to the Cast. As always, please like, listen, share, and subscribe. We appreciate any love from you fine people. If you're on iTunes, please give us a big old 5-star rating. It helps our visibility and it's much appreciated. And when this video pops up on YouTube at some point, please give a like and subscribe there. If you want to say hello to us, we are at Link to the Cast on Twitter. Please say hello. We always enjoy talking to anyone that listens to the show. As always, I am at Lithium Project. He is at Jack Lazell. And when he is around, which he should be next week, at Day to Dave, as he is away on assignment this week, but he should be returning hopefully next week. Jack, it's been a pleasure as always. I look forward to seeing your face in a few days' time for the first time in what, like 18 months or so?
Yeah, probably maybe 2 years, mate, to be fair.
So, that's going to be awesome. So the next time we chat, we'll probably be in person. So that's cool. And we'll be wearing suits and that'll be fresh and fly. But until then, for another episode of Link to the Cast, I have been Mark Robinson. Have a wonderful week. And we'll see you again next time.
Bye.